It's September of 2014. Thousands have gathered in the Ziggo Dome of Amsterdam to celebrate the United Nations International Day of Peace.
This concert is being broadcast in many, 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 many countries. And one of those countries in which we will reach millions of people is Myanmar, formerly Burma. The country is slowly moving towards peace and democracy, and local journalists even tell us that this concert is sure to help accelerate that process, so that's a good thing. And this is why it is so fantastic that we have one of the most famous artists from Myanmar perform with a very famous artist from the Kachin people, an ignored minority in Myanmar for a long time. They wrote this song together in Myanmar. They are here tonight, live in Amsterdam. Please give it up for El Lung Wah and Pew Pew Cho Ting.
In the Southeast Asian nation of Myanmar, less than 1 year later, an unprecedented genocide would begin. And 7 years later, in early 2021, there would be a coup. Hello and welcome to the Finch Podcast from the Finch Media Group. I'm Alex Benoit.
And I'm Will Fang. Last week, you heard from Angela Stent, a world-renowned expert on the Russia and its cunning leader, Vladimir Putin. President Putin met with President Biden last Wednesday, and many of our guests' predictions came true. Needless to say, we'd suggest you pay close attention to this episode as we travel south to Myanmar, because this, too, is concerning.
Every Friday, for the rest of the summer, you can expect to hear from our team. If you like what we do, please subscribe and leave us a rating. And if you're new here, we dissect complex issues. This is The Finch.
If Myanmar's history has been a long march towards democracy, the Southeast Asian nation faced a major setback earlier this year.
The country of 54 million people on the eastern coast of the Bay of Bengal recently underwent a coup. The military, known as the Tatmadaw and led by Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, ousted the de facto leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi.
Myanmar's relationship with its military is long and complicated, but the armed forces have long enjoyed privileges in the legislative process. A recent election, which brought Myanmar closer to limiting the military's power, led to the February arrest of Suu Kyi on bogus charges of importing strategic communications devices. The military blamed 6 standard walkie-talkies used by her security personnel.
To make matters much, much worse, the nation had already been undergoing and executing what the United States calls a genocide. Since 2015, the military has been systematically pillaging, raping, and killing the Rohingya ethnic minority, living in the Rakhine state. Over 100,000 people have been beaten, 30,000 thrown in fires, and 20,000 raped, displacing millions into nearby Bangladesh.
Importantly, Suu Kyi, a former Nobel Prize winner and recipient of international praise, was silent throughout what the United Nations has labeled as ethnic cleansing. The country, now grappling with widespread scorched earth policies, is being economically, socially, and medically decimated, leaving international experts and academics scrambling to find solutions for this grim prognosis.
One of those experts is Joshua Kurlancic, a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He specializes on studying the collapse of democracies and the rise of populism in Southeast Asia, and China's sway on the region at large. Formerly at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the University of Southern California Center for Public Diplomacy, and the Pacific Council on International Policy, Kurlancic has written as a columnist for Time, The Economist, and Mother Jones. He is the author of several books on state capitalism and populism, and now he's on The Finch. Thank you so much for coming on, Mr. Kurlancic. It's an absolute honor.
Thanks for having me.
To get started, the first question I have is Burma or Myanmar? Which is it?
For years, it was called Burma, first by the British colonialists, and then it was called Burma by the democratic opposition during the earlier junta period. But then the junta changed the name formally to Myanmar in a prior junta period. And but eventually, Suu Kyi and most of the other democratic opposition basically accepted the name Myanmar. So I don't. The U.S. and a couple other countries like the U.K. still continue to use that, but I think calling it Myanmar is fine personally to me at this point.
Okay, so we'd like to set the scene a little bit for what's going on since February. And to do that, really, we have to start even before February with Aung San Suu Kyi's rise to power with the National League for Democracy. You've written about how that political party is popular, mainly because Aung San Suu Kyi is popular, but that political party actually left out some individuals and some ethnic groups, and part of that played out in 2015 with the start of the Rohingya crisis. Could you talk about who Aung San Suu Kyi is and her party?
Sure. I mean, Aung San Suu Kyi started a long time before 2015. So she was the daughter of the independence hero of Myanmar, Aung San, who was sort of the leader of a group of people who fought British colonialism and was the transition figure to independent Myanmar or Burma, was assassinated before the country could really get going. So Aung San Suu Kyi had always come from a sort of almost a famous, almost royal heritage. She first came to notice in 1988 when there was massive demonstrations against a military regime at that time that were crushed. Thousands of people were killed at that time. And she became a political figure at that time. She hadn't really become a political figure before then. And in the years between 1988 and 1990, she and several other people founded the NLD. And in 1990, even though Myanmar was under military rule at that time, the military allowed essentially a free and fair election in 1990, probably because they thought they were going to win, that their favorite party was going to win wrongly. And Suu Kyi was under house arrest during the election, but the party won demonstrably a massive amount. And the junta didn't recognize the outcome of the election. And then there was junta rule for essentially another 20 years with Suu Kyi under house arrest for most of that time, and the NLD shuttered or partially shuttered. Then in the early 2010s, for a variety of reasons, Myanmar began to open up a little bit. They moved from pure junta government to a kind of transition government led by technocrats and a former general. And eventually Suu Kyi was allowed and out of house arrest and allowed to participate in politics again, and the NLD was legalized again. Then in 2015, they had another free and fair election, and the NLD won massively, took power in 2016. And then in November 2020, the NLD, again, despite there were some minor, perhaps, irregularities, won a massive victory in national elections. The military's favorite party did terribly. They claimed there was flip fraud, and that was the supposed, as well as some other stuff, supposed impetus for the coup in February 2021, although that's probably not the real reason. When Suu Kyi was under house arrest in that whole long period where she was basically isolated and she had little communication with the outside world, she won the Nobel Peace Prize, she was like feted as a global icon, U2 wrote songs about her, she was a symbol of resistance. I think the world just didn't know that much about her. There probably were some inclinations at that time that Suu Kyi was perhaps a somewhat more authoritarian figure than she seemed, and that she probably had a little bit less tolerance for dissent than it seemed. But that was subsumed by the fact that she spent this whole period under house arrest, and it was hard to know what, in great detail, what she thought. Then when Suu Kyi was in power, or some degree of power, because the military still held power between 2016 and 2020, although it was a democratically elected government, they didn't do a very good job. Suu Kyi proved to be intolerant of dissent, although nowhere near the level of the junta now. They weren't, Suu Kyi's party wasn't out assassinating people and put, but people were put in jail for criticizing the government. Journalists were put in jail. And she didn't seem to have a whole great deal of sympathy for the large number of ethnic minorities in Myanmar. Myanmar is a fairly diverse place. Most notably, in 2017 and other times, the military committed just a complete scorched earth policy in Western Myanmar, in Rakhine State, against the Rohingya. They committed what's been called crimes against humanity or genocide, and Suu Kyi basically did nothing. It's unclear what she could have done, but she did nothing. Not only did she do nothing, she essentially sanctioned this massacre and went to international court in the Netherlands to essentially defend the military's actions. So while within the NLD, within her party, she also sort of became or remained fairly intolerant of dissent and the type of sort of idea formulation that bubbles up in a party, so that everything and all the top decisions were being made by her, and people, younger people in the party, younger politicians, etc., wanted to propose things. She wanted to have the sort of normal dynamic of a political party where there's some degree of give and take. We're frustrated.
As Alex mentioned earlier, the National League for Democracy, or NLD, largely neglected Myanmar's ethnic minorities. Can we expect the National Unity Government to be more inclusive, and can we have hope that they will establish a government that appeals to all people of all backgrounds in Myanmar?
Sure. I mean, I want to say just one other thing about it. Although I think that Suu Kyi did not do a great job of, and the NLD government did not do a great job of sort of recognizing the diversity of Myanmar and doing enough to make ethnic minorities feel like they belonged in the NLD. They did win massive numbers of votes in ethnic minority dominated states. And Suu Kyi initially pushed for a peace process. A number of the ethnic minorities have armed organizations that exist in the periphery of Myanmar that have been at war with the Myanmar central government for decades. So she made some attempts. As for the sort of national unity government, which is sort of attempting to create a parallel government to the junta, I think beyond the national unity government, there is some hope for the general population, younger activists and the type of people who have led movements in Myanmar since the February 1 coup, which isn't necessarily the national unity government. It's more amorphous groups of activists, particularly younger activists. I think there has become more of a recognition that if Myanmar is ever going to be a democracy at some point in the future, and to be frank, I mean, I think the situation is extremely grim and going to be grimmer. I don't have some great, you know, optimistic prognosis, but were it to be, that it needs to be a federal state, which has been anathema. The idea of a federal state has been anathema to most Myanmar politicians since the time of Aung San Suu Kyi's father. So by a federal state, I mean that power needs to be devolved from the central government extensively to provinces, to states and provinces, the same way it is in the United States or other federalized countries like Germany and others. The sheer diversity of Myanmar requires that. So I think, and also among younger activists, I think there's a recognition, unfortunately belated, but that the army was taking these scorched earth tactics for years in ethnic minority areas, tactics that range from rape as a weapon of war, forcing people to be human landmines, outright summary execution, many other policies which would be considered crimes against humanity. They're now taking those policies, and a lot of sort of ethnic majority people living in the middle of the country, like even if they didn't support the military, those were happening in the periphery. Now the military has turned, and we could talk about other things, summary executions of activists, poets, mass roundups, firing live rounds into people's houses with no clear pattern, burning down towns and villages. Now those tactics since February 1st have been turned against, they continue against ethnic minorities, but they've been turned against people in the Burman or majority group heartland of the country. And so it's unfortunate, but that has probably led to some feeling among some of the ethnic majority people that they have now really witnessed the full scale of the brutality of the Myanmar military. And there is some more unified sentiment. As for the National Unity Government, I'm not sure. You know, I think they some people in it recognize that to be credible on the international stage, they need to reflect Myanmar's diversity. But there are a lot of people from the National Unity Government who come from the former pre-coup government who themselves had expressed fairly unsentimental, if not outright racist sentiments to Rohingya. So I'm not sure.
This isn't the first time that there has been a junta in Myanmar.
No, it is not, unfortunately.
Right, and it seems that this one is just on the same, if not worse, amplitude as past ones, including the one in 1988 we referenced where thousands were killed. What seems to be the endgame here? We know Min Aung Hlaing wanted to be in power. You have yourself said that following the disappointing loss for the pro-military party at the end of last year, there were indications, and by all accord, it seems that this is why Suu Kyi was arrested.
Can I just stop you there for 1 second? I don't think those were maybe the grounds for it. I think that there was indications that the leader of the Myanmar military considered a coup as long ago as 2019.
Okay.
And that
it's pretty evident that they arrested her for, she wasn't the president at the time, but she was the figurehead of the government.
Right. Yeah. She wasn't the president due to an arcane part of the constitution the military created, saying that someone who had been married to a foreign non-national of Myanmar could not be president. And that was like a clause simply written to exclude Suu Kyi from the presidency because she had been married for many years to a British man who was a famous Tibetan scholar. He passed decades ago, but she was the de facto civilian leader. No, my point is simply that probably the reasons why the military decided to make this move as in the lead up to the coup was that the victory combined with a sort of more assertive approach by some in the NLD suggesting that with a victory, they were going to finally try to take measures to diminish the military's power through various means. So I think that the military, the reason is a combination of that and just a sort of paranoid ideology in the military that simply posits that no one but the military really can stabilize or control Myanmar. And not ideological in the sense of like left or right. The military has no ideology like in that way. In the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, the military portrayed itself as socialist. But I mean, there was nothing... It was nothing really socialist. It wasn't like socialist or even social democratic. And then in the 90s and 2000s, they were capitalist. The ideology is simply one of maintaining power and a lucrative military company set up and sources of revenue.
You've said that now there's just sort of become this widespread application of prior tactics that were used against the Rohingya that are now being used against other minority groups, including the Burmese. What is the end game here for Hlaing and his party to just basically be killing its own citizens? Is it just to instigate fear so that the protests start dying down?
Yeah, I mean, I think originally the end game probably was that the Myanmar military probably thought they could have a coup and quickly quiet the population and be accepted to some extent on the international stage, or they would get enough international recognition that they would be viewed as having legitimacy, and then maybe they could, over a couple of years, create a situation where they could finagle the political system in various ways to have sort of pro-military parties be elected, and so that they could pretend they were a democracy. Something similar, like while maintaining power, something similar like that has happened in Thailand, and that completely failed for a variety of reasons. One, the scale of the blowback among the protesters was probably much greater than the military anticipated. And remember, at the time that they're doing this, like the U.S. is only a few weeks after the presidential election, which resulted in months and months of chaos. Countries around Myanmar, many of them have become increasingly authoritarian. The world's distracted by a global pandemic, etc. So not only did they get a much more aggressive pushback from protesters, they didn't get recognized immediately by other Southeast Asian states. A number of leading democracies took a sort of more forceful response. So they switched from, if you look back in the first couple of weeks after the coup, there was quite a lot of large nonviolent protests through the streets of Yangon and other cities, which were allowed to happen with relatively little incident. They seem to have recognized that this strategy of pushing for legitimacy, you know, from countries from Southeast Asian countries, from others, wasn't really working, and switched to a scorched earth strategy. They've brought in divisions from some of the areas where the military has used scorched earth tactics against ethnic minorities, and have started to apply these tactics nationwide. It's always difficult to say what the quote unquote end game is of the Myanmar military, because you're talking about a fairly opaque institution that doesn't really offer much insight and doesn't interact that much with outsiders. But I would say that the end game is simply similar to 1988 to 90 period, or there've been other periods like this, 2006, 2007, where they hope to kill and imprison enough people, as well as cut off the internet enough communications to create a crackdown that the protests stop. They have a fair amount of resilience for several reasons, the military. There isn't a lot of dissension in senior officer ranks. They don't really need to worry about officers splitting off and having a sort of counter coup. They have arms from Russia and other suppliers. So there's an arms embargo against Myanmar, but they continue to purchase arms from Russia. So they have a supply of arms. Even with sanctions, and remember, the U.S. is a very small player in Myanmar. The players with really significant influence are Thailand, other Southeast Asian states, China, and Japan. Those are the actors with significant influence. And the Southeast Asian states, while not recognizing the government, haven't really done that much to condemn it. And the military has other sources of revenue, even if more aggressive sanctions were to be put in place. They have illicit sources of revenue, narcotics, gems, and other sources. So they have a fair amount of resilience. So I think now, having devolved from their original plan and gone on the offensive, their plan is simply to do everything possible to quiet things down. And if that means ruling over essentially a destroyed, almost failed state, which increasingly is happening, they're willing to do that. And given that level of willingness, it becomes very challenging to come up with policy options in response, as I think the world is recognizing.
We spoke to Russian expert Angela Stent last on Russia's tactics towards combating democracy and upholding Putin's power. You mentioned that a similar narrative was unfolding in Thailand. Can you just discuss the broader overall trend occurring in Southeast Asia with the collapse of democracies?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not a Russia expert. Russia's obviously not committed to democracy, but I'm not sure that Russia's interests are in Myanmar necessarily that broad. Like, I agree they're not generally favorable to democracy, but that they're not that they're necessarily like there to or have been there in the long haul to try to undermine the democratic government. Russia is more opportunistic, in my view, in Southeast Asia. Places where they can wield some strategic influence is fairly far from Russia's borders. They will take that opportunity. Arms sales is a significant source of revenue for Russia. And so they are always looking for arms clients. Anytime they can also sort of just stick their thumb in the eye of leading democracies, whether or not it necessarily has to do with undermining democracy, it provides them with something that seems to, they seem to like take that approach. But Russia isn't like have long-term, in my view, strategic interests in Myanmar, other than selling arms and just generally sort of reasserting themselves in a place that opportunistically. The region as a whole, one of the things that has probably helped the Myanmar junta is that the region as a whole has regressed democratically in the last 15 years or so. And not all, but so you have places like Thailand that were relatively democratic in the early 2000s that are now sort of a hybrid authoritarian democratic regime. You have places like the Philippines, which since the mid-80s was the most robust democracy in the region, and also the one most willing to call out other countries in the region for rights abuses and be assertive about it. It's now run by Rodrigo Duterte, who was democratically elected but has undermined democracy in a number of ways. You have other states like Cambodia, which were never democracies but have been made some progress, have now reverted into outright autocracies. And you have even Indonesia, which it remains a democracy, a fairly robust democracy, and has been for since the late 90s, but still has been backsliding somewhat. So overall, the regional environment matters, and the more sort of authoritarian or hybrid authoritarian leaders you have in the region, the less likely they're going to want to be saying anything bad or putting pressure on Myanmar because they don't want it rebounding against themselves. Indonesia remains a fairly robust democracy. And then there's a small country, Timor-Leste, which was once an Indonesian province of East Timor, which also remains a fairly robust democracy. And there have been some other modest improvements in Malaysia, at least before COVID, and in Singapore. But overall, the region has regressed significantly in the last 15 years, along with most of the world.
A lot of people have written about how difficult it is for journalists to cover the situation on the ground, and even how difficult it is for humanitarian aid to get in because there's chaos and because the junta is blocking a lot of communication across the country. Obviously, the international community has expressed its disagreements. Biden has gone out and said a statement. But you've spoken about the fact that the Southeast Asian nations composing the ASEAN group haven't really condemned this, in part because of member states themselves are going through similar trends, albeit maybe several years delayed. So the situation is quite tricky, but in your position on the Council on Foreign Relations, is there anything that can be advised as to what can be done moving forward without just waiting and seeing and hoping for the best? Are there any concrete measures that can be taken here?
Yeah, well, to be clear, I mean, some South Asian states have condemned the violence. It's just that when they held an emergency summit to discuss Myanmar, they didn't really take measures that I think are likely to be very productive. And Myanmar government is stymieing their plans to have a special envoy enter the country. So they're not doing that much else, but they have condemned it. I think the international community is sort of stuck. I mean, I think there are a series of things that could be done to try to alleviate the suffering somewhat, but in terms of policy options, it's going to stop a junta with that doesn't really care about brutality, that doesn't really care about what the outside world thinks about it, that is willing to not leave the country where they would potentially be subject to prosecution and brought to an international court, that has streams of revenue that possibly can't be touched. It's a very challenging situation. I mean, I think the U.S. and other actors could put pressure on banks that still do business with joint ventures and other companies in Myanmar. So international banks could be warned by the Treasury Department and notified that they should not be doing business with joint ventures and other companies in Myanmar that are where the military is in the joint venture. Since they can't really stop, the U.S. has no real act, or other actors have no real power within Myanmar. I think that the U.S. and other actors who have power in the region, Japan, Australia, others, should put pressure on the Thai governments and others who are on the front line of where Myanmar refugees are going to be fleeing to, because there is already and it's going to be an even greater exodus of people from the country. Some of the countries in the region, unfortunately, have forced people back into Myanmar. And that exodus is the U.S. and other countries need to put pressure on regional governments to allow people in and to be willing to provide money to back up that pressure. The Biden administration has granted anyone who's a Burmese national who was already in the U.S. before the coup temporary protected status. So if you were a Burmese national but not already a U.S. citizen or green card holder, you now have temporary protected status. But the number of people that applies to is very, very, very small. So I think the administration should go farther. And I mean, I realize that this is an issue to make claims for many parts of the world, but should commit to a higher refugee cap next year and should work with governments in the region to ensure an allotment for people from Myanmar. This has been done in the past in other emergency situations, and that other countries in the region that have similar approaches towards refugees like Australia should do the same and New Zealand should do the same. But there's not a great toolbox of a great option, unfortunately.
If you like what we do, please make sure to like and subscribe wherever you're listening to this episode. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at The Finch Media, or online at www.thefinch.media, where you can find a transcript of this episode as well.
People have lived on the Burmese Peninsula for thousands of years, and revolt is nothing new. A former colony of Britain, the young nation has lived through a series of coups and crackdowns, each longer and more violent than the last. Yet, some on the ground continue to have hope that this is not the end of Myanmar's liberation, but rather just the beginning.
The National Unity Government represents the broadest coalition combating the military's reign in history. The National League for Democracy is there, of course, but so too are other factions. The sheer gravity of the junta's policies has affected everyone, and in a way, made it no longer tolerable for citizens of Myanmar, whether from the Rohingya or Burma ethnic backgrounds.
With little intervention from the surrounding regions due to the onset of democratic collapses in Myanmar's neighbors as well, the international community has been called to act. As the military ravages the country, depleting sources of revenue and sustainability, economic sanctions may hurt Hlaing's junta the most. Will Myanmar bounce back like it has before, or will February's coup mark the end of Suu Kyi's long fight?
These next few months will tell all, but next week we turn to the skies. The National Centers for Environmental Information recently announced that 2021 will be one of the 5 hottest years on record. And if you live in Canada, the Pacific Northwest, or the Northeast, you can sure as hell confirm. This podcast has covered how climate change will impact the Earth, but next Friday we ask Dartmouth College's Justin Mankin on how climate change will impact people, mass migrations, climate counterterrorism, and more. In 7 days, this was The Finch.